Welcome to the Royal Caribbean Blog Podcast, your weekly look into the world of Royal Caribbean cruising. I'm your host, Matt Hochberg, and this is episode number 533. This week, I want to talk about what you need to know about going to Europe for the first time. With it being May now, the European cruise season has begun, and a lot of people might be taking their very first European cruise, or might be thinking about taking one in the coming years. At any rate, we've got a cruise expert on with us to talk about the major things you need to know going from North America to Europe up next. The great thing about Royal Caribbean is it cruises to places all around the world, including Europe. And, of course, with the European cruise season beginning here in May, a lot of people excited for their cruising, and in a lot of cases, maybe even their first European cruise. When I think of European cruises, I think of my very good friend, Emma, from Emma Cruises. Emma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Of course. I got to tell you guys, when I went to Europe, actually, we're recording this, believe it or not, the exact one-year anniversary of my first European trip, when I went to Europe for the very first time. And when I went to Europe, the first thing I did was, like, I got to learn everything about Europe from Emma, because Emma, besides the fact that she lives in the UK, that's beside the fact, but, Emma has a plethora of information about this. And it's kind of interesting, Emma, that cruising is a very universal product in the sense that, you know, especially on the major lines, whether it's Carnival, Norwegian, Royal Caribbean, but there's something about going from one region to another, especially when it's North America to Europe, that mm-hmm. there are just so many little nuances and je ne sais quoi about the experience that just differs slightly enough to give a lot of people, I think, a little bit of pause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. For me, it's the other way. You know, I cruise mostly in Europe and I come over to the States sometimes. And so I feel it in reverse. So hopefully in this podcast, I'll just undo what I noticed about cruising in America. And this will make sense. But yes, I love cruising in Europe. I have done so many Mediterranean cruises in Norway, Canary Islands. I think I've completed most of them. I've done the Baltics. I can't think of any I've not done around here. So
it's really interesting. And of course, you know, we could spend hours talking about the different regions, whether you're talking about the Mediterranean or Northern Europe or where have you. But in general, I wanted to really help folks who are going on their very first European cruise to mm-hmm. understand essentially what their approach should be, some of the big things they should know. And let's talk about obviously getting to Europe and, some mm-hmm. of the major places there and logistics involved, because even you in the UK, I mean, you know this. I mean, if you're going to Barcelona, if you're going to Rome, there are, just like in North America, you've got to account for logistics. And I would even argue you need a little bit more padding mm-hmm. for those logistics when it comes to traveling there. Talk to us about what's your advice for traveling to Europe, especially, you know, airfare and getting around to the embarkation ports.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to want at least a few days, not just for the logistics of getting to some of the cruise ports, which are not near the airports, but you're also going to want to get used to the time zone. And it can be quite tricky going that way. You sort of have to force yourself to sleep when you don't feel like sleeping. So you're going to want at least a few days. I mean, if you can come over and have, I would really love like a week in Italy or a week in Spain or somewhere like that before a cruise. That's fantastic. I understand not everyone can do that, but at least a couple of days. Some places, like you say, Rome, the port of Rome is nowhere near Rome. Normally I'll get on a local train, maybe a taxi, but I will always give myself a day to do that journey, even though that's only, it's a couple of hours, but you don't want to go all the way to Rome and then miss your ship. It would be terrible.
What's your, I remember you telling me this a year ago, you prefer, it's easier to go east to Europe or go west to back to North America in terms of jet lag?
I find it much easier to go west and make myself stay awake rather than make myself sleep.
That makes sense. Okay.
So coming over from the US to Europe, I think that's harder. Sorry. Yeah. But because you go, normally when I go back in time to the US, I can just have a day that's 8 hours longer and you can just force yourself to stay awake. But when you travel forward and you maybe skip a night, that's quite tricky. So yeah, don't underestimate the jet lag. I'm quite used to it, but still it takes me quite a while to get into the time zone.
Yeah, I remember even coming to Europe. I mean, I did pretty well. I was actually surprised how well I did. It also helped, I think, my flight time was good because it was an overnight mm-hmm. flight. Yep. And then by the time I got into the airport and out to my hotel, it was already like the afternoon. So I only stayed up for a couple more hours. And then it was time to go to bed anyway.
Yeah.
But any advice for combating jet lag? Because I can really, I mean, it can really get to you, especially those first couple nights of the cruise. It's like it feels like you can barely make it to like 9 o'clock at night, and then you're just falling over asleep.
I mean, I like to take advantage of it, to be honest. I'm on my last cruise, I was in my head 9 hours ahead of the actual time. So I was first there at dinner at 5:30, the restaurant opened. Don't fight it. If you want to eat, if you normally eat at 8, but now you're hungry at 5, just eat at 5. That's kind of an advantage. They say food is the key, don't they? Oversleep. You know, if you need to have a nap to get you through, that's okay. But if you can eat at the right times, I think that's key. You don't want to be waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning really hungry, because that's really hard to go back to sleep when you think it's lunchtime.
That's a very good point. Absolutely. Let's talk some logistics things and things that are actually surprising to me. When you travel, no matter where you are in Europe, cash not really necessary, right? You just go rely on credit cards.
Yeah, normally if I'm taking a cruise to the Mediterranean, or I'm going to Greece, somewhere like that, I'll make sure I have some small coins. Sometimes you have to pay to go to the public restroom, like a euro, so I make sure I have coins for stuff like that. But I can go, you know, normally I'll do a week Mediterranean cruise, never use any cash. We just use contactless cards for everything. Same in, you know, British Isles cruises. I haven't used cash here in 6 months or something. We don't really, because we don't have, you know, we have pound coins and euro coins. You're never going to tip someone like a pound the same way you might in the
Sure.
US. You might slip someone a dollar. You don't do that. That'd be really weird. Other than I have a little bit of change sort of for emergencies and really just for public restrooms. But even saying that, you know, I went to a public restroom in Germany, had contactless card payment. So, but yeah.
It's surprising, actually. I think for especially for Americans, because cash is still very much used in a lot of situations, and over in Europe, it's just there's really very little impetus to ever use cash. Never mind the trying to get some of it. So,
If you're in, you know, if you're in Spain, Italy, France, the UK, Norway, I don't think I've ever really used cash in any of those places. Obviously, if you're going somewhere maybe a bit more off the beaten path, might be worth having some in case you want to get a drink and there's not a card machine. But yeah, for any purchase that's going to be more than 10 euros, you're going to use a card. So yeah, don't worry about it.
cool. I know one of your big mantras for shore excursions planning. You like to do a lot of things on your own and not necessarily rely on the cruise line. Now, obviously, we can't go through every single region and every single nuance there, which, by the way, Em has some great articles on her website, emmacruises.com, which has
Thank you very
a
much.
lot of specific, like all of Norway. I just went through your articles and I was like, okay, that one check, done, done.
Oh,
Okay.
good. I'm glad it's helpful.
So, what's your general recommendation for folks for their approach to planning a shore excursion in Europe?
So I like to use the research of the cruise line, because they've done all the research, right? They found all the best things that are there. I will look at their excursions and I'll see something and I'll think, oh, I'm in Genoa, right? They have an aquarium. That's nice. Never been there. Then I will look at the price of that, $55 or whatever it is. Then I will go to the website of the aquarium in Genoa, 35, and I'll book it there. And I'll look on Google Maps and I'll walk the 10 minutes myself. And then when I walk in, I'll walk by the big group that's come from the cruise line and I feel very smug. So that's what I like to do. I'm quite happy, you know, if I need to get on a train or a bus or something like that in Europe, I feel quite confident in doing that. I understand not everyone does if they've come a long way. But I think just having a look at what the cruise line suggests, and can you book that hop on hop off bus by yourself? You know, it probably stops outside the cruise port anyway. In some places it's been, you know, they'll add on $10 if they give you the tickets on the cruise ship. If you get off, if you go buy it with your card just outside the cruise port, you save $10. So I definitely use their research, you know, why not? They've already done it. But unless something is particularly difficult to get to, if I need a ferry or something, maybe I'll do the cruise line one. But most places I walk an awful lot on most, you know, Mediterranean cruises, because you can and you see things that you didn't even plan on seeing. Some of the best things I've come across, I didn't mean to. If I'm walking around in Greece, you just come across a ruin that's 1,000 years old and you didn't even know it was there. It's just in the middle of the street.
It's true. And obviously every port's different, but in general, I think it's a great idea. Speaking of some of these places, how do you deal with the language barrier, in terms of, you're going to France, Italy, Greece. What's been your experience and any tips and advice for how to deal with that?
I think we're very, very lucky in that if you go to a cruise port in Spain, Italy, France, Greece, any sort of place where cruise ships dock, a lot of the people who are there in the shops are there for the cruise ship tourists, and they speak English. I've never had any problem. If they don't speak English, you know, a bit of hand gestures, pointing, you can translate, of course, learn how to say yes, no, please, thank you. I think that's just polite. But normally, as soon as I say hello in another language, they realize I'm English and they just ask me something in English. So I've never had a problem with it anywhere. You know, if they're getting 6,000 people coming off this cruise ship in a day, they know that they're going to be tourists. And often, you know, I'll be on a cruise, say I'll be on an Italian cruise line going to Italy. Even still, the other people who are on that ship, some of them are Spanish, some of them are French, and English is normally the common language. So if they don't speak Italian, they'll speak English. Same with all the crew on the ships, they'll all speak English. Even if you take a German cruise line, English is the sort of common language. So I think we're very, very lucky.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds a lot like, you know, you go to Mexico. I mean, it's the same thing. Most people, everybody speaks Spanish there, obviously. But when you're in a tourist area, that's definitely the case. Do you still find that's the case in ports that are a little further away from the port? Like, you know, Rome is one example, right? Because that's a basically an hour away from by train. So the fact that you're, I mean, you're in, but it's still a tourist city to some
I mean,
extent. Is that fair?
no, they're very used to cruise ships there. I mean, I've never had any problem going to a train station and buying a ticket. You know, the machines will have an English button. That's always been fine. The only time I've really had any language problems was when I was in a place like Japan, for example, where you kind of expect it. But in Europe, there's English buttons on everything. If you want to just go to a McDonald's, press the English button, get a Diet Coke, no problem. You can just Google what is 34 in Spanish and make sure you know it for when they shout it out. But I've never had any problems. You don't need to worry about it. I know people worry about it a lot, but you can get by. Even if you don't speak the same language with someone, it's amazing how much you can get done. You can have a full conversation anyway.
There you go. Awesome. You've obviously, since you've cruised a lot in Europe, you've seen your fair share of Americans on board. What are some mistakes, perhaps? What is like the most common mistake you've seen North Americans making on in a European cruise?
I will say occasionally I see people who have, for example, a Rolex on their watch, on their wrist, or a massive, very expensive thing that they're just waving it around. And obviously there's pickpockets in places like Rome because there's lots of tourists there. And I think the biggest mistake is some people, they don't hide away any of their things. You know, you don't need to, if you have expensive jewelry, you don't really need to wear it out in the port, do you? I'd be worried about losing it. But every so often we hear a news story of, you know, someone stole a £15,000 necklace. Well, why? You were wearing it? Like, I don't know. That just surprised me. And I noticed that quite a lot, like really expensive cameras. It's no worse a problem than it is anywhere else. But I think some people just, they're so excited to be on holiday, they sort of lose a bit of common sense sometimes. Not specifically Americans, though, just that's, I do notice sometimes.
No, I mean that makes total sense. You know, and that's, by the way, that's good advice for anywhere, whether you're in Cozumel, Nassau, or you know, Rome. So, when you're looking at a European cruise and you're the onboard experience, certainly, do you find among the major lines? I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about Costa or P&O or anything like that, but if you're talking about the major line, let's use Norwegian because I know you cruise a lot with them. The experience is pretty universal across the board in terms of Europe versus North America.
Yeah, I think so. I've done Norwegian cruises quite a lot in Europe. I've done some from the US. I think maybe the entertainment is slightly different. They're a bit more interactive in the US. They do a bit more game shows where people go up on stage, whereas it might be a bit more, you know, a bit calmer with just live music happening, maybe in Europe. But apart from that, you know, the food is the same. The ships are the same. They don't change anything on board. If they, you know, sometimes European companies will buy American cruise ships, and I find it really interesting how they change those. For example, some of the British cruise lines have bought what used to be Celebrity ships or Royal Caribbean ships. They rip out the casino and they put a pub there, which I think is just the most British thing ever. But just if it's a normal, you know, a normal Norwegian ship or Royal Caribbean ship, there's no difference. You can still do all the same things you would normally do. And I think I actually prefer a cruise when there's different people from different countries on there because everyone gets spread out and people want to do different things. If I take a cruise where it's all Americans or it's all British people, everyone seems to want to go to the same shows or everyone wants to go to trivia and those things become really busy. But if you do a cruise where some people are from America, some are from England, some are from Spain, some are from Germany, you find that people sort of spread out quite nicely. So
For sure.
that's always my preference.
I'm going to give you three ports, and I need your help with logistics because these seem to be
Oh,
the big three people always want to know about. I'll start with an easy one for you.
okay.
Southampton. I'm
Oh,
going on a
yeah.
cruise to Southampton. I'm flying over from North America. What is your preferred slash best recommendation for how to get to Southampton as a North American flying in?
Yeah. If you have not a massive amount of luggage, the train is the easiest. I would personally do the train. But if you're someone who has, you have two suitcases, the trains are not particularly great. They do have some space for suitcases, but, you don't want to be trying to look after your suitcases for hours. So probably a taxi, or we would say a coach. Do you say coaches? Like a bus? Like a
A
coach?
bus. Yeah,
Yeah,
no,
well,
just a
we
bus,
call
yeah.
them like a coach, like a long distance coach. There's so many of those that go from the London airports down to Southampton. So yeah, it's a couple of hours at most. If you don't have a lot of stuff, train. If not, coach or taxi, I would say.
Yeah, and for air, what's your what is the perfect airport to fly into in the
Well,
UK?
I mean, Southampton does have an airport, but you're not going to
True.
get
Okay.
there
You're right.
unless you're going from Amsterdam or something like that. So we have five London airports now, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But probably London Gatwick or London Heathrow are like the main biggest ones that are on the train line. Very, very easy. Yeah.
Cool. How about this is it? I know Royal Caribbean does this. I'm not sure about other lines, but Venice, aka now it's Ravenna, in order to get there and back and
Yeah.
forth. What's your recommendation for how to get between those two places?
So I haven't done any since they've moved them out of Venice. So
Okay.
the last time I cruised from Venice, what I'm picturing in my mind is that lovely, sail-in that used to be fantastic. So I haven't done that. But I have taken, Italian trains before. I will say I've done some of the local Italian trains and then some of the faster Italian trains that are more expensive and more touristy. And I would pay for the more direct train, especially if you have suitcases, because you end up just standing in the aisle with everyone, and it can be
Sure.
quite a lot. But I would be looking at probably a train, or if not a taxi, it is fine and fairly easy and probably not too expensive. It's not very far, is it?
Yeah, and number three, I think you kind of answered this already, but Rome was the other one I was going to ask you about, how to get from the city I can't ever remember the pronunciation for that begins with a C.
Yeah. I say Civitavecchia, but that's not how it's said. And every time I say it, people correct me, but that's how I say it in my accent.
Sure. West Rome.
Yeah, so I've done the very local, very cheap train. I've done the faster train, and I've also got a taxi. The very cheap, very local train is fine. It gets you there, but it's not. It was very hot when I was on there. It was very busy. Obviously, people are going to work. It's a normal train. So I would recommend the more expensive. There's a more direct train that you can get that's mostly cruise passengers and tourists. Or if there's more of you, then a taxi is not more expensive. If I'm with three other people, then it's just the same price for all of us to take one taxi versus buying four train tickets.
Makes sense, absolutely. What's the what's your number one cruise tip though in general when you're approaching a European trip? Because obviously we're looking at this from the lens of North Americans, but in general, what's your top tip for someone who's going to Europe in terms of a must do or a piece of advice that really stands out to you in terms of your approach to a European cruise?
Yeah, I think my top tip would be realistic on how much you can do. Because if you're taking a 7-night cruise where there's five different countries, you have long days in ports normally, but there is a limit on what you can do. And people come over with a to-do list that's, I'm going to see 15 different things in every single day in every single country, and you just get exhausted. Like, it becomes just a marching around, see this, see that, see that. Like, give yourself time to sit down and have an ice cream. Like, don't give yourself too much pressure is what I would say, because that's the fun of cruising, right? It's sort of just
Yeah.
going with the flow. I'll have a look at one of the top five things to see in this place. I'll make sure I see them, and then after that, some of the best things I've found are not things I was looking for. So yeah, I think people need to sort of don't put too much pressure on yourself. I understand, if you're coming across from the US and you've got one day in France and you really want to go to Paris, but that's a really long journey. It's like 2.5 hours each way from the port. So just give yourself a bit of time to relax. Don't put too much
Sure.
pressure on yourself.
Something that's I remember for my trip, and I asked you incessantly about this, are strikes. Because in the US it really doesn't happen, but in Europe in the
Yeah.
summertime especially, strikes are very common, or the threat of a strike is very common. What is your best advice for how to plan around a strike?
I think as long as you have the backup option of getting a taxi, then it's fine. You know,
Okay.
there's never really going to be a complete taxi strike. Or we have Uber, we have things like that as well here. More often than not, I would say train strikes are threats. They do happen occasionally, but even if they happen, there'll still be a cut down service. So they
Yeah,
might
yeah.
threaten to strike, and the threat is we'll do a Sunday service on a Tuesday, that kind of thing. So yeah, don't worry too much about it. As long as you have a backup, and this is not, don't leave it. So I've got one train that I can get that gets me into the port, going back to what we said earlier about getting there, you know, a day early or 2 days early. Yeah, as long as you have time to fall back on a backup plan, then it'll be totally fine. Probably it will not even happen. Normally they get called off, but yeah, there's always various things in, you know, France, or I don't really understand all the strikes, but sometimes, yeah, they
I
seem to
just,
happen.
it happened to me when I came and there was a threat of a strike. I think it did happen, but like you said, there was just reduced service and there was still the train that went there. And I
Yeah.
also learned, I think from you, that a lot of times the strikes are more attempts to get vacation time where they want to get time off. So they use that as a mechanism to get that. And it's, yeah,
Exactly that.
it's less about the labor, the nature of labor and worker. It's more just the way that it goes over
For
there. So,
something, yeah, normally, yeah.
yeah. And I guess the other thing, since we're talking about it this year, the Olympics in France, anything that you're changing this year for your
No.
approach to cruising in France?
Nope. I haven't seen it affect anything yet.
Okay.
If that change, if that happens and it changes, then maybe, but it's not really for me to work that out. Like, if a cruise line is going somewhere, they'll sort it out, right? That's the fun of going on a cruise, is it's someone else's problem.
There you go. Well, Emma, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. I think these tips are great. I'm hopeful that these like basic European cruise tips will help everybody have just a better approach to the European cruise. And obviously, if you're looking for more advice about how to cruise to Europe, do exactly what I do. Go to Emma's YouTube channel, Emma Cruises. Watch her videos. No matter how old they are or new they are, they're always relevant. They're always helpful. Good port specific information. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
Anytime, this has been fun. Thanks for having me. I feel like I'm representing the whole of Europe, which is kind of cool.
It's time for listener emails. This is the part of the episode where I answer the emails you've sent me. And we're going to start with the first email. And this is coming to us from Ricardo from Argentina. Hi, Matt. I'm an avid consumer of your podcast, blog, and YouTube channel. My family and I have only cruised once on the Disney Dream, but now we have booked a Greek Isles cruise on Explorer of the Seas for July 2025 as part of our European vacation. My daughters, who speak little English, will be 15 and 11 at that time. My questions are, will my youngest daughter be able to participate in the teen club activities with her sister, or are they strict regarding the age limit? If so, do you recommend we try to get them together, or due to her age, is it better that she participates in the children's club and leave the teens club for a future cruise? Thank you very much for all the information you continually offer to us. This is a good question. 11 is tough because you're on an Explorer, and I believe on the older ships that don't have the new Adventure Ocean, Teen Club doesn't begin until 13. You could certainly ask. I mean, obviously, there's a maturity level here, right? And there are very mature 11-year-olds and there are very immature 11-year-olds. I would say, in general, in terms of programming, I think the 11-year-old will be better in Voyagers. I mean, I get that the kids want to spend time with each other. There's a certain camaraderie that's there, familiarity. I totally understand that. The thing I'm concerned about, obviously, with the teen club is that the 15-year-old, I mean, there's like going to be 13-year-olds, going to be 17-year-olds. It's a big age gap, even from 11, especially in terms of that maturity again. So one thing you could do, obviously, is go on board the ship, talk to the teen club staff about that. You could certainly ask. You know, you never know, but I don't want to paint a picture that anything's guaranteed. When it comes to aging up or aging down your kids into one of the teen or Adventure Ocean groups, in general, you can simply ask. You go there and you say, hey, here's the situation. And they may simply say yes, no, or we have to see how busy it is, or somewhere in between. But I guess, besides the obvious answer, what I just told you, where you could do, 11 is, again, it's close, obviously, but that could be a concern that I would have just in terms of the maturity and teenagers being teenagers versus the 11-year-old who would be right in the middle of those ages for Voyagers. So, anyhow, Next email is from Michael from Colorado. My wife and I did the last cruise in 2023 on the Royal Princess. I enjoyed it immensely. Wife, not so much. Primarily, the stuff with the motion sickness and because she was ill for 7 days. With that said, she did go on all of her excursions. Now she's open to a 3 to 5 day cruise. Which cruise would you recommend with Royal Caribbean? Now, I'm going to assume you're not talking about Alaska anymore. You're talking about, like, in general, 3 to 5 day cruise. And the good news, if it makes your wife feel any better, is that generally speaking, I feel like the ocean conditions are a little calmer in the Caribbean than they are in Alaska. There is not a guarantee on that, by the way. I've got seasick in the Caribbean plenty of times, so it's not like it's, you know, something that you need to assume that that's not going to happen. That being said, there's a couple things. Number one, in terms of seasickness, you know, Bonine is your best friend. I recommend this a lot and for good reason. If for your wife who already knows that she's prone to motion sickness, 24 hours before your embarkation day, take a Bonine, keep taking one every 24 hours. I think that will greatly help quite a bit. In terms of, you know, open to a 3 to 5 day cruise, I like the 5 day cruises a lot more. The 3 night cruises are very short. They're usually on weekends. It's more of a party vibe. When you get to the 4 and 5 nighters, even though it's not that much longer, there's just a different vibe to them. And the other great thing about a 4 or 5 day cruise is you get to go so much further away than like just the Bahamas. So certainly a cruise that is a 4 or 5 day cruise that goes to like, you know, Cozumel or somewhere in Puerto Rico would be fantastic. So really what I would recommend you do is look for ideally a 5 night cruise. A lot of the 4 days still do the Bahamas with an extra sea day there, which is nice. Nothing wrong with that. And obviously you've got Utopia of the Seas. And that's another advantage if you do a 3 or 4 nighter. Is that it's a very short distance. Usually the sea conditions in the Bahamas are a little bit better than when you're out in the open ocean. No guarantees, obviously, but I might look at Utopia of the Seas. I might look at Independence of the Seas, Freedom of the Seas, ships like that that offer those kind of sailing. So there you go. Next email is coming to us from Victor, first-time cruiser from Canada, going an 8-day Freedom of the Seas cruise in November. What's your experience and recommendation for choosing a dining time? We usually eat later, 7 to 8 p.m., but I'm concerned that might be too late for long and busy days. Any perks either time's offered? It's 6 of 1, half a dozen of another. Like, if you do an early seating, and I've generally moved towards early seating personally after doing late seating forever, if you go to early seating, it feels like you get out and you have the whole evening ahead of you. There are shows and there's things. Whereas late seating, it feels like you get out of dinner at 10 o'clock. And there's still seating, by the way. I mean, obviously, if you're in late seating, you'll see the shows before dinner because that's how that works. But I just don't love the feeling of getting out of dinner at like 9:30, 10 o'clock and then feeling like, okay, it's like late night already. Not that it's late. I'll still stay up. But there's just something about like when I get out of dinner at, say, 7 o'clock and then I feel like, I got the whole night ahead of me. I don't know. There's just something I've evolved from, because if you listen to the podcast years ago, I swore up and down how much I preferred late seating. And of course, with late seating, you don't have to worry about necessarily getting back to the ship super quickly after a shore excursion. And to your point, you might be too late for long and busy days. I would say actually a late dinner is good for, if you have a lot of shore excursions planned, the good thing about a late seating is it gives you more time to get back to the ship, relax, like take a nap and shower and change, as opposed to just like run back on the ship, shower, change, and go straight to dinner. Or even worse, cut off your time in port because you need to be back in time for, you know, dinner. There's pros and cons, Victor. I don't want you to look at it as one is superior or a overall better choice, more of a personal preference. Victor also says, also, we want to eat at one of the hibachi or Italian restaurants at a minimum, but we're also considering purchasing a 3-day dining package. I know the first meal is pre-booked, but any advantages or disadvantages to booking this way? No. The disadvantage of a dining package is you can't make reservations until you get on board the ship, so you need to go do that on embarkation day. But you're going to save a lot more money that way, so that's definitely the way to go about it. Thank you for the email. Our next email is from Chris. Thanks for doing what you do always. I haven't been cruising since my Explorer of the Seas cruise in August 2022. Pretty much what having a kid will do to your cruising calendar. My wife and I booked an 8-night on Harmony of the Seas at a Galveston with my brother and sister-in-law, plus a true YOLO booking on Navigator of the Seas out of LA for 4 nights with our neighbors. Needless to say, we're making up for it. My question for you, although simple, is we're currently scheduled for a second seating in the main dining room, but want to change it to my time. Do I have to change this through my travel agent, or can we wait to change this on board the ship? The answer, Chris, good to hear from you again, is both. I would say your best choice, the number one we should do first, is ask your travel agent to change that. It's just easier, simpler. That's the way to go about it. You could wait to get on board the ship, but then it's just more of a hassle and there's no guarantees on it. So yeah, definitely go about your travel agent, have them make the change. If they say, hey, it's too late, ask them to have you be put on the wait list. That usually comes through in my experience. Our next email is from Brady. So I'm booked on Adventure of the Seas Transatlantic out of Orlando in October, and it stops at Cocoa Key on the way out. Ever since I booked it literally a year ago, it hasn't shown nearly enough excursions for Cocoa Key on the website. I can only see cabanas and the kayak excursion. Why is this? As I've looked at my Symphony cruise a month prior, it has literally everything. Do you have a reason for this? You know, Brady, I wish I had a good explanation as to why the Royal Caribbean cruise planner acts the way it does, or does one thing over another thing. In a lot of cases, the further out your cruise is, it's not surprising or unheard of for that to be the case. So that just may simply be that you're just too far out. And I mean, Cocoa Key is a little bit of an exception, because I feel like they usually have that stuff preloaded in there. But at any rate, don't sweat it too much. Just keep an eye on it. I think it'll eventually populate in there. Our next question is from Mark Wilson. My question is about cruise ports that are convenient for air travelers. I live in San Diego, and we must have one of the easiest ports to navigate for passengers arriving via air. The airport is literally only a mile from the cruise ships, and there are hotels directly across the street from them. Unfortunately, Royal Caribbean rarely stops here. Not sure why that is. I had an easy time with Fort Lauderdale, but places like LA, Galveston, Miami, and Orlando all have airports that are far from the ships. What Royal Caribbean ports do you consider convenient for air travelers who also need a hotel? Also, which ones do you consider challenging? Ooh, good question. Fort Lauderdale is the easiest one, because Port Everglades is right next to the airport. So it's like a hop, skip, and a jump away. Easy, easy, easy. I would say if you fly into Newark, Cape Liberty is very convenient. It's still about a 20-minute ride away, but at least it's still a lot closer. Like, you know, Orlando to Port Canaveral is about 45 minutes. Although I would argue there's probably less traffic Orlando to Port Canaveral than there is Newark to Port Liberty, but that's a different discussion for a different day. Galveston is probably the worst, followed by, I don't know that Port Canaveral is really the worst, but I would say Galveston and Port Canaveral, just because they're just the location. Galveston is like, there's Galveston and there's everything else. Like, Galveston is just a logistical, consideration more so than any other place in the U.S. Miami's not too bad. I mean, Miami's about half an hour away. It's all highway. Traffic can be an issue, but if you're there on a weekend, it rarely is. There's tons of hotels. I feel like Miami is probably the easiest. Well, second easiest. Fort Lauderdale is the easiest. Fort Lauderdale, Miami. LA is a pain, just because it's just not. It's not as far as Galveston, but traffic can be nearly as bad and make it feel worse than that. So I might actually change my list here. I'm going to say the worst is Galveston. Second worst is LA. And then Orlando, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, if that makes sense. Good question there. Cape Liberty, I forgot how to put, I would slide Cape Liberty in, probably right around Miami somewhere. Next question is from Nate. Love the show and all the work you and your team do. I'm going on a transatlantic reposition cruise in November on Odyssey of the Seas from Rome to New Jersey, and it's been my first cruise in Europe. There aren't a lot of options for excursions to Royal Caribbean, and I want to do some price shopping. What is a trustworthy site to look for outside excursions? Also, for five ports, how many euros would be appropriate for some light local shopping, as well as some snacks, potential taxes on transportation while on land? It's also new to me. I'm not sure quite where to start. Nate, this is, I did not time this, but this is a perfect email for this week's episode. I hope Emma's advice really helped you with this. I would say in general, you don't need a ton of euros, as we talked about in the episode. You know, your credit card with no foreign transaction fee would be what you want to have with you. That's really important. As for trustworthy sites for outside excursions, Viator.com is a really good one. Viator is a great choice. And do what Emma said. Look at what Royal Caribbean has to offer. Google those shore excursions. See what other third-party tours you can come up with, or maybe just do it on your own. But definitely research ahead of time. You know, so you have a plan for logistics, how to get there. But in general, like when I went to Europe, and I said this in the episode, I didn't bring any, and I didn't spend any currency. I use all credit card. Now, obviously, I was in Norway and England, and those are maybe different than Southern Europe in terms of their approach. But I would have, like Emma said, maybe just have a few euros that you convert over in the airport, and otherwise really rely on the credit card for most things. Because even small snacks, like you'd be surprised, food carts, they take credit cards. So thank you, Nate, for the email. That email, by the way, would have been a lot more of a longer, it would have been a much longer answer if we had Emma on this week's episode. Our last email today is from Nicole. Hi, Matt. If I do the St. John on your own excursion, how would you recommend I get around the island? Taxi versus car rental? There'll be 3 or 7 of us. That might make a difference. Or is there a beach right where Royal Caribbean drops us off? Snorkel rentals there. Definitely taxi. When it comes to on your own, I did this exact one, Nicole. And it's a bit of a, I don't want to say it's a bit of a farce. It's a bit, because you have such limited time, like you end up with basically about 90 minutes on the island. We ended up taking the exact same taxi that everyone else was taking that booked the excursion that included it, if that made sense. So just take the taxi. Like, honestly, if you can, if it's not too late, keep what you have if it's too late. But I would cancel and rebook the exact same tour that offers like a beach break, which basically is code for they include a taxi with it. It's going to be the same basic thing there. The problem with renting a car is that it's going to take too long. You're going to waste too much time and it's going to cost you too much for the value. If you were there the entire day, cool. But every time I've done the St. John on your own excursion, Nicole, like, first of all, your ship is in there from what, like 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. or 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. Like, it sounds like it's a lot, but it's really not. And you only have about 90 minutes of time at the beach. So the taxi is the way to go about it, Nicole, by far. Thank you to Nicole for the email. Thank you to everybody for checking out this episode of the Royal Caribbean Blog Podcast. Of course, if you want to send me your email, you can do so by sending it to Matt, M-A-T-T, @RoyalCaribbeanBlog.com. Until next time, I'm Matt. We'll talk again real soon.